Now it's time for a weekly look at the top national news stories. President Trump proposed rule changes yesterday that would effectively ban bump stocks. Here he is speaking to reporters and Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I signed a memorandum directing the Attorney General to propose regulations to ban all devices that turn legal weapons into machine guns. I expect that these critical regulations will be finalized, Jeff, very soon.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's idea, the decision to ban these so-called bump stocks? Is it a good idea? Is it enough to help curb violence? Should the minimum age to buy more firearms be raised to 21, as some lawmakers have proposed? Call 800-642-1234. And do you think something is changing in the gun debate right now? Call 800-642-1234. Paul Singer is with us, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, everyone. How you doing?
Good. Well, before we get to specifics, the bigger question after this shooting in Florida and the activism of the survivors of that shooting, is something changing in how we talk about gun control?
You know, it's hard to tell, honestly. This is not an uncommon theme in these situations where, you know, in the days and weeks immediately after one of these tragedies, we see an awful lot of energy and enthusiasm and activism for some kind of gun control, which usually ends up running into a wall when it gets to the U.S. Congress or the White House, where there's just never been a whole lot, or at least hasn't been in the past decade, a whole lot of enthusiasm, particularly in the Republican-controlled Congress, for any kind of new legislation. It's a little different this time for a couple of reasons. I think one is that I think the faces of these young people who have been very, very active is really helping drive some conversation to this topic. And the second is that this president is so, open-minded on various topics that it's never entirely clear whether he is in favor or opposed. So there seems that there could be a window here for something, in part because we don't think the president is going to take the traditional stance of we don't want to do anything. But what he would actually support remains a little murky.
Now, with these bump stocks, this is something that came up in the big Las Vegas shooting last year. These things that modify guns, they raise the effective rate of fire of a semi-automatic weapon closer to that of an automatic weapon. The president saying stopping them. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein says, you know, Congress needs to do this. Do you think this could happen?
Well, the last time this came up after the Vegas shooting, these things have been reviewed by the ATF before, and apparently at the time they more or less concluded they didn't have the legal authority to actually ban them, but they're now going back, and they said at the time they're going to go back and look at that decision and see if they could figure out another way at it. So remember that what the president ordered the Justice Department to do is to write a regulation. Well, that, of course, is a long process. It can take years, is open to all kinds of legal challenges from people who would still like to manufacture this particular product. So if it's going to get done, it would obviously be quicker to do it through legislation, although, of course, legislation also needs a regulation to implement it, so there's that. But it is something that Congress has said they'd be interested in, although Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said the last time around that he would rather see it done through executive action in the agencies, regulations, not through Congress acting. We'll see if that mood has changed at all.
I want to bring on a caller or two on this. Michael starts us off in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. As far as I see, this bump stock thing is just a distraction. The bump stocks really won't make any difference in the scheme of things. You have to do something to get some of these automatic weapons, the AR-15s, out of the hands of people. At least cut down on magazine capacity, maybe a 10-round capacity. People running around with, 30, 40, 50, 100-round magazines, that's just insane.
Michael, thanks for the call. So he says keeping these AR-15s, semi-automatic versions of them, out of the hands of citizens. What kind of other changes, apart from bump stocks, are people talking about in Congress? I've seen some suggestions that, hey, we could maybe change the age limits on some of these firearms.
Yeah, well, for starters, your caller is right that the bump stocks is a pretty esoteric portion of this debate. This is not the main, you know, issue. You know, solving bump stocks is not going to solve your guns problem to the degree you think you have one. There are a whole bunch of other things out there. I think the thing that's most interesting at the moment is there's a bipartisan effort that the president appears interested in and that Senator John Cornyn in Texas, the number two Republican in the Senate, has been leading. It's called the Fixed NICS bill. And the idea here is there is already a background check system, but that there are holes in it because agencies don't necessarily report all the appropriate information that's supposed to be in there. So the FBI doesn't know, for instance, that you maybe were adjudicated, you know, in some court somewhere, or I believe there's an issue that the military had not properly reported disciplinary action to the FBI background check system. So the background check is only as good as the system, as the information that's in the system. So this bill would look to shore some of that up. There's also, keep in mind, you know, we've got a spending bill coming up in a few weeks. They're trying to figure out how to fund the government for the rest of the year. There will be several efforts to boost the background check system in there with more money to do background checks more quickly, more possibly more money to improve the technology, possibly more money to improve the amount of information that's going in there. And then, of course, you'll have a conversation again about whether there are background checks should apply to additional weapons purchases, particularly what we always call the gun show loophole, meaning that if you buy a firearm from an unlicensed dealer in these cases, or a friend or a family member, what paperwork is required. You'll see some of that rise its head again. Whether or not it has support to pass is a different question.
Talking to Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He stays with us as we look into the week's political news. Coming up, new developments in the Russia investigation and Mitt Romney back in politics running for the U.S. Senate. We pick up the conversation now on the week's top political news with Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, I want to move on to another issue now, the latest in the Mueller probe, the Russia investigation. We had all these indictments of Russians on Friday. Now a Dutch lawyer living in London pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI this week. What are we seeing in the latest there?
Well, this is one of those cases where we were looking at this one trying to write a headline for the story, which is basically guy you've never heard of and gently related to this case is, you know, pleading guilty. And it really looks like this is a fellow who was apparently working in cooperation with Paul Manafort in his other job. That is, Manafort had been a lobbyist for some Ukrainian government interests. This fellow apparently was working with Manafort on some kind of project for the Ukrainian government. What this has to do with Trump and Russia, of course, is a little bit of a thin line, but I think the theory is that they are trying to make a case, build a case against Paul Manafort for some sort of criminal activity that would lead Paul Manafort to then want to plead guilty and begin cooperating with the investigation. Paul Manafort, of course, was for a while Donald Trump's campaign CEO. So obviously, he'd be a worthwhile guy to have cooperating with the investigation. And that's what it looks like this particular guilty plea is about, is more about putting the squeeze on Manafort than anything directly related to President Trump.
And before that news, but after those Russia indictments, the president tweeted a lot about this over the weekend. What did we see?
Yes. Yeah, you know, the president has been tweeting a lot about, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been saying from the podium, that all of this proves there is no collusion with the Russians and also proves that they had no impact on the election. Neither of those facts is true, or neither of those claims, sorry, is true. What these indictments say is that some unwitting people on the Trump campaign were engaged with these Russians, but they don't say that that means that there wasn't some intentional collusion. They haven't gotten that far yet. There's at no point has the FBI or the Mueller team said conclusively there was no collusion. They just have not yet said that they have any evidence collusion. Similarly, I mean, you can't really say that there's evidence that the Russian hacking didn't have an effect on the election. What they seem to be saying is that it clearly didn't. They don't think it affected any direct voting. The Russians didn't penetrate any voting systems and change any votes. But they had an influence campaign going on through social media to try and sow dissension amongst American voters. Whether that changed any minds or turned any votes, we don't know, and you may never actually know. There's no way to tell. You know, did that campaign ad lead to a vote? We don't know.
To be continued there, I want to turn to a new candidate for the seat of Senate, a senator in Utah, a familiar name, Mitt Romney. Here's a little bit of a campaign ad released last Friday.
I have decided to run for United States Senate because I believe I can help bring Utah's values and Utah's lessons to Washington. Utah is a better model for Washington than Washington is for Utah.
Let's talk about the Romney-Trump relationship, often rocky. What did we see after this announcement?
A lot of peacemaking. The president apparently called Governor Romney over the weekend to congratulate him on getting into the race. President Trump had apparently been urging Orrin Hatch to stay in and to not retire and to run for re-election and to sort of elbow Mitt Romney out, but once Orrin Hatch decided to retire and open the door for Mitt Romney, it looks like everyone's going to try and make nice here. Mitt Romney has tweeted his thank yous to the president for his best wishes and that he plans to come here and work in Washington on the issues where they agree. He has said in interviews that he plans to obviously continue to speak his mind where he disagrees with the president, but that he thinks that on agenda items, on conservative issues, he thinks that they're going to agree more than they disagree.
And as we wrap up, Paul, we follow you on Twitter here, and there's been a lot of a flurry of tweets related to your typing activities. You use an old-fashioned typewriter, or at least you have one as a prop. I'm not sure which.
My handwriting is terrible, and so when I leave notes for people, I type on a manual typewriter. So I always have one here, which by the way, I'm hoping to show off with a photograph of me in my new WPR T-shirt one of these days. So,
excellent.
You know, guess I'll have to pledge.
All right. And are you a connoisseur of typewriters, or is it really just practical for leaving those notes?
No, I have about a dozen of them around the house. I prefer when I'm typing, I prefer to, or if I'm thinking, or if I'm keeping a journal, if I'm writing for my own personal purposes, I prefer the speed of a typewriter. I prefer the rhythm and the sound of it. It's more like jazz, and I find it more inspiring. I don't really like computers much.
In 10 seconds, Paul, you've made me want a typewriter. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. You be well.
That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us for a look at the top political stories of the week. When it comes to special elections in Wisconsin, they may not be the flashiest events in politics, but they do play an important role in our government. Typically, if lawmakers leave office before the end of their term, the governor, in theory, calls for a special election to replace them. But like everything else in politics these days, the reality can be a bit more complex. Case in point, some eyebrows were raised when Governor Walker opted not to call special elections to fill a state assembly seat and a state senate seat, both of which opened up late last year after the previous office holders took jobs in the Walker administration. That means both seats will remain vacant until this year's midterm elections in November. That got our friends over at WisConText thinking about special elections and whether or not the governor's decision was rooted in precedent. So our next guest dug through nearly 50 years of state election records to try and gather some data on these elections. The result is a new series you can read right now at wiscontext.org. Scott Gordon is the associate editor for WisConText, and he joins us with an overview of that series. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the news that's going on now, Governor Walker's decision to not call special elections, so no elections till November on these two open seats. What have we heard from the governor about why?
Well, there's a few different justifications that have come out of the governor's office for this. One is that the language of the state law governing special elections technically allows them to do this. And it's a long story, but basically they're saying because these two legislators resigned their seats in 2017 rather than 2018, which is the year of the regularly scheduled election, they don't have to call the special election. Of course, you know, they did resign within the last days of 2017. So it's a bit of splitting hairs there and a bit of spirit of the law versus letter of the law, I think would be fair to say. They're also saying, well, you know, special elections cost money, and pointing out that these legislators, no matter what happened, wouldn't really be able to be seated in time for the legislative session that's wrapping up now.
So, yeah, one little fine point. If they had, instead of resigning effective December 29th, the last weekday of 2017, if they'd done it January 2nd, if that was a weekday, I don't know, if they'd waited that 5 days, we would have to have an earlier special election. Is that right?
Apparently so, based on the way that they're interpreting the law. And yeah, I mean, based on what the law actually says, they would have to if they resigned in January, and there wouldn't be this ambiguity.
And now critics have said Governor Walker should hold an election. You're leaving parts of the state unrepresented, technically, in the legislature. What kind of arguments are we hearing on the other side of this?
Well, the legislative staff is still in place for both of these offices. And, you know, obviously legislative staff can do a lot that's helpful for constituents, but that's still not the same, of course, as having an elected representative. And beyond the part of the year where legislators are actually debating bills and voting on them, you know, they're still doing stuff, interacting with constituents, studying issues through committees, probably raising some money, stuff like that. So it's not a job that necessarily ends when the legislature is done voting.
Now, let's get into the main part of what you did with this WISC context piece. The question is, this is a long delay of special elections. Is it an unusual delay? So how did you try to set out to answer that question?
We basically looked through state records of when elections have been held, when legislative seats have become vacant, either through a legislator, you know, dying in office or resigning, or in some rare cases, you know, being removed from office because they were convicted of a crime. And we also looked at executive orders that governors had issued calling special elections, which helped us. And basically, going back to 1971, we were able to piece together, you know, a whole spreadsheet of when vacancies happened and when elections happened, you know, to the best of our ability through scraping through legislative records and so forth. And through that, we were able to kind of calculate the intervals that usually happened in these vacancies.
And before we look at those intervals, these are special elections. They're special. They're not that rare. These do come up fairly often.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's fair to say it's part of kind of the routine business of keeping state government going is, you know, legislators are people like the rest of us with unpredictable existences. Sometimes things come up. Sometimes they die or get really sick, and sometimes
or get a cool new job.
Sometimes they get a cool new job, which seems to happen more and more frequently as you get into the modern era. But yeah, and so of course that this has to happen every so often is they have to be replaced so that those seats are represented in the legislature.
And then you tackled that interval between the effective resignation and when a special election was called. And it looks, looking at your charts, like it's kind of all over the place in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to put a number to it that's the normal baseline for it. But if you look at the vast majority of these cases, and we looked at about a little over 100 cases where a special election was called to fill a vacancy, for the most part, that's happening within, you know, 50 to 100 days. That is the interval between the vacancy opening up and the actual election happening. You know, under state law right now, once you call the election, you have to wait between 62 and 77 days to call it. So, of course, there's a natural delay built in just because of the way the law works. But Walker's decision to leave these two seats vacant for a little over a year is really a major outlier to all of this.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about special elections in Wisconsin, and let's get to that outlier. How does Governor Walker's delay on these two appointments compare with what else we've seen over the last, what, almost 50 years?
Yeah, it's way out there. I couldn't find another example in all this research going back to 1971 of a time when a legislative vacancy stretched on for that long, whether or not it was filled by a special election. We also, you know, obviously tried to dig up as many vacancies as we could that weren't filled by special election for one reason or another. You know,
that means they just wait till the normally scheduled election that would have happened if the legislator had stayed, right?
Right. And there's instances where just because of the timing and the way the law works, that makes sense to do. But yeah, I couldn't find quite anything else like it. And I did ask the governor's office, well, you know, is there a precedent for this? Was there an example that you've seen of this that you would cite to justify this, and they declined to offer any examples?
And so in a nutshell, these seats will be vacant for more than a year, right? December 29th of last year through the elections this year. And then those people who are elected in November don't actually get seated till 2019. Do I have all that right?
That's right.
And the past examples you've seen, the outliers before this were about 200 days. Do I have that right?
Yeah, there's been a few of those that we found. And again, you know, there could be any number of things behind that. We weren't really able to figure out exactly what the reasoning was in waiting a little longer on those. But even so, those were a couple of rare outliers, and this most recent thing with these two vacancies is an outlier far beyond even those.
Let's dig a little deeper into history. You went back to 1971 for this analysis. In part, that's because things changed. The rules changed. The procedures changed. Things were different in the past.
Yeah, and, you know, usually the records that you're working with just aren't perfect, and you try to make the best with what you have. The folks at the Legislative Reference Bureau and the Wisconsin Historical Society were really helpful in, you know, pointing us to the correct resources. And yeah, and sometimes when you get further back into history, the records that you might need might be a little bit more scattered or just harder to find.
And you cited a report from the mid-1960s, and one of these special election examples they give was a young, fresh-faced fellow named Fred Risser.
That's right. That kind of tickled me to see because, of course, I live in Madison, so he's, you know, my state senator, and we all know that he's, you know, I think the longest-serving state legislator in American history or something like that. So it was funny to see that kind of, you know, not everything changes, but a lot of things do, I guess.
Are there any efforts to change, clarify, make more precise our special election law in Wisconsin?
Well, Democrats in the legislature have filed a bill that would basically make the language in the special elections law a bit more specific. Right now, it requires the governor to fill seats, quote, as promptly as possible. And this would actually put a solid number to that, saying that the governor has to call a special election within 60 days, because obviously, as promptly as possible, that leaves a lot of things open to interpretation. And even in that report that you mentioned from 1963 that someone wrote at the Legislative Reference Bureau, they were pointing out that the language of laws and the Wisconsin Constitution that govern all this really do give governors a bit of wiggle room as to what to do. And you know, in this case, at least, they're running with it and arguably inventing more wiggle room than actually exists in the law.
And there's a political background behind all of this. People are watching special elections in state legislatures pretty closely this year, watching for signs of what might happen in the big elections in 2018. Democrats, after losing a lot of seats in state legislatures over the last bunch of years, they seem to be picking up a lot of seats in these. So Democrats maybe would like these special elections to happen to pick up seats, and Republicans maybe would want to hold off.
Sure. I mean, I've had it pointed out to me that if Democrats could, you know, score that surprising victory in the 10th Senate district, then these two districts that were vacated could possibly be within reach. And, you know, you see these some upsets happening here and there. There was that election in Kentucky just this week. And, you know, some seats in Virginia and so forth. And it's true that Walker kind of staked out his position on not holding these special elections before the 10th district election happened. But even before then, of course, there were lots of indicators that this could be something that would actually be competitive.
And an interesting sidebar here. You think of academics and political scientists, they study the heck out of everything. You talk to some academic researchers, special elections don't get a lot of attention.
That's what I found. Yeah, it's a surprising thing because it's routine and it does have some, you know, influence over what happens in state government. Less the special elections themselves than just the implications of when a legislative seat is vacant. So it was surprising to me. And also it makes you a little more trepidatious as a reporter when you're trying to like flesh out something and there aren't, you know, there aren't these other bodies of work out there to refer to see like how does what I'm finding measure up to what other people have found? So that was really interesting. It was really shocking to me.
You ventured into uncharted territory. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Scott Gordon, associate editor of WisContext. He joined us to talk about his new series on the history of special elections here in Wisconsin. You can read more at wiscontext.org/special elections.